Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
You're watching Consider This. Tonight on the show, we're going to continue the ongoing conversation around the climate crisis. Sir David Attenborough has warned us that the moment of crisis has come in efforts to tackle the climate crisis. So what can you do to help your city adapt to the realities of climate change? Joining us on the show today, we have the co-authors of the newly launched book titled Creating Future-Proof Cities, How to Navigate the Climate Crisis. We have Murali Ram as well as Rexy Prakash Chako. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is the book that you co-authored and it's newly launched. Now, the book tries to prescribe a localized response to the climate crisis, and you use Penang as a case study. So, why did you choose Penang, Murali?
Well, we are both from Penang,
okay.
and we live in Penang, or in my case, I lived in Penang. Penang is a good test lab. It's small, it's manageable. So using Penang as a case study, this is basically what can you do if you're in government in Penang or you're an individual in Penang, what can you do? But it's equally applicable to any city.
Okay.
Right. What would be the components for... taking this into action, would it be a state government that is mindful of these issues or already put in place some things? A civil society, a very active one that we have in Penang, not replicated necessarily across the country, and so on and so forth. I mean, universities that are doing research or individuals, and in the case, I think, Rexy, you do quite a bit of research on, and you've actually produced a book on nature trails in Penang, and I've even watched you give a presentation on the kind of work that's going on that you do. So all that, is that equally available in all parts of Malaysia, Rexy?
Well, I would say it's something which is holistic, where all parts of society need to act on. So it's a responsibility, it's a collective responsibility. The individual, the community, and also the government has to play. To say that... yes, Penang is a lab of sorts. We have a very good model. It is applicable to other cities in Malaysia. It just needs to be replicated. Mm. And we started with Penang because this was a good example which can be emulated in all the other urban areas.
So who is this book for? Who is it targeted to? Are you thinking about the individual who needs to make changes in his or her life, or is this targeted to... educating government, policymakers, the corporate sector? Who is it for?
In essence, we wrote it for the policymaker. So city makers, people in local government and also state governments, mm. but also for communities, because you need to understand in simple terms what's going to come. And you need to call for action. So to answer your question earlier, who makes the difference? Actually, it's the general populace.
Okay.
You need communities to demand for action and say, look, you know, maybe that's not the right thing to do in this climate. Maybe we should think of other more sensitive measures, that sort of thing. Because governments respond to what voters want. And when voters are more conscious about the climate crisis and what's coming, then they understand measures that are put in place and they'll welcome it and also demand for it. So you want to get to that end of the spectrum.
So can I just get an assessment from both of you where you think the level of awareness is in terms of addressing the climate crisis for the general populace? Are we aware? Are we just kind of choosing not to act on this awareness? What do you think, Rexy?
I think the awareness is pretty much contained within the urban areas. The thing is, the word needs to spread into the rural areas. And the thing is, the rural population are already seeing the effects of the climate crisis, but they're not putting the dots together to see that it is a global event that is happening. And to address that, the thing is, the word needs to get out to them in the lingua which they are familiar with, which is in Malay. And that is, of course, the thing that has to be done, not just by the government, civil society, and individuals like us as well.
But, you know, we look at a society like Australia in their recent crisis over the fires. I mean, from the very top of Australian society, the Prime Minister himself, you know, a climate denier, along with a whole host of very educated people also denying a link between climate change and the fires that were happening in Australia. It doesn't seem to be, to me at least, a question of education or even vocabulary. It's a kind of mindset issue that many people who are educated just refuse to accept the kinds of painful trade-offs that are going to have to happen in order to do something like future-proofing cities. I mean, morally.
Or, sorry, just to add to that, if not just the mindset, but also perhaps, you know, the inability to think or the feeling of being overwhelmed and say, I'm one person, I'm not going to be able to make a difference. It's the government and corporations that need to change.
So it's not about being educated generally. It's about being educated about this issue. So coming back to the, I'll come to your question, but earlier, when I was a child, we used to learn alam dan manusia in school. You actually learn about you and the environment and what's the interrelationship, interdependency, etc. There's no such thing here. So I've got a couple of kids in school. When I talk to them about issues such as, you know, don't do this and, you know, carbon emissions, they look at me like, what are you on about? So we need to get the conversation in schools. So in fact, this is something that, you know, if I can have a one-on-one with the Minister of MESTEC, I'll probably say, can you work with the Education Ministry to introduce something in school that talks about climate change?
There's nothing in the curriculum
there's
at the
nothing,
moment?
Well, as far as I can see, my son is in, he's 16, there's nothing in the curriculum. Okay. And, you know, we go through the homeworks, I ask them, I quiz them, they don't know anything. Mm. So it's not about being educated, it's about being educated about the subjects at, you know, of the environment and how it relates to people. Mm. And in terms of general population, you would think about 10-20%, you know, are probably aware and the rest are not. And that's why you have these climate deniers and all that, like in Australia, you know.
Currently Penang is going through a crisis with regard to water, right? And that's also an effect of climate change. How's the response been? And people actually joining the dots, as you put it, between this, you know, call now by the state government to save water or conserve water, their personal choices and what they understand about the climate change globally?
Well, I think it really depends on how the message is actually put across. I would like to commend the state that this time it came out directly to the population and urged them with the data and the facts to actually save water based on how grave the situation is. Looking at the press release a few days ago, we are only 44% of the amount of rainfall that we received in the last 4 months. It's just 44% of what it was 4 months, 4 years ago. Wow. So when people see the data, when people see the concrete facts, that's when they believe and that's when they stop denying. And it has to be channeled in such a way.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and come back and take a closer look at what we can do specifically in mitigating the effects of the climate crisis. Stay tuned to Consider This. Welcome back to Consider This. Melissa and Sherrod here with you. And so we are speaking to the co-authors of the book Creating Future-Proof Cities, Murali and Rexy, here on the show, talking about... So the book essentially serves as a practical guide for individuals and communities to step up action in mitigating the effects of the climate crisis. Now, I know the effects of climate crisis, me as an individual, but what can I do specifically in my household and as part of my community that so that I can contribute to stopping the effects in this world, in the city? Rexy, why don't you go?
Yeah, I think one of the most important actions that we need to take is to stop the wastage. In particular, stop the wastage of food. Because the thing is, most people don't realize about 8 to 10% of global emissions actually comes from food wastage. So we need to understand that we only purchase the food that we eat, and we also eat the things that we purchase. Don't have that waste. And another part of it is also what we eat. And when I talk about what we eat, it's important that we start transitioning to more plant-based diets. Because when we look at meats, for example, the thing that when a loaf of, say, a chicken or meat comes on your table, you don't actually see the amount of land which is invested in actually growing the chicken or growing the produce to sustain the cows, the chickens, the livestock. And I wanted to take one example, the Amazon fires. Of course, this was about 4 months ago, but many people don't see the connection between the Amazon fires and how the ranchers in Brazil were actually lobbying for the clearance of the forest in order to grow, in order to farm the livestock.
Right.
So this is one thing that
we have to do. I want to move from individual choices. I mean, I think there's a lot of emphasis on what individuals can do, but perhaps what will have greater impact is what we do on a collective level, especially cities. Now, and because your book is about future-proofing cities and specifically about strategies that are out there, Murali, talk us through some of the components of this strategy to future-proof cities.
Okay, so on the mitigation side, you know, we talked about there's also public transportation. How do you put in public transportation? How do you deter people from driving, right? How do you encourage people to walk and cycle, things like that? But from a city's perspective, you need to understand what is the effects that are going to fall upon the city. Then devise strategies to address that for adaptation. Mm-hmm. So there's mitigation, there's adaptation. So we're talking about heat stress. We're talking about floods. We're talking about drought. So because of extreme weather, there's also the rising sea levels. So you know Jakarta, for instance, is relocating its capital because they can't cope. The city is sinking because of subsidence, because they're taking water out of the ground. And then there's also sea level rise. And the two combined doesn't pose for a good future scenario. So they're moving their city to Kalimantan. Bangkok is also talking about moving their city as to where they haven't decided. But these Malaysian cities that are immediately in danger of sea level rise, Teluk Intan, for instance, Batu Pahat, Alor Star, capital city for Kedah, and also Nibong Tebal in Penang. So these are low-lying areas. So if you go on the websites, there are several websites that give you simulations. You can tell in about 10 to 30 years, quite a lot of these areas, substantial amount of land are going to be underwater. So you have to decide, do you continue investing and building in these places? Do you start planning to transition populations out? Do you put in hard infrastructure that's going to cost a lot of money? So New Orleans, for instance, is having this very same problem. So it's not new, but we have to start thinking ahead. Other cities like KL and Penang, so heat stress and all that, how do you address
heat
it?
Stress.
You know?
Can I ask you, I mean, are these scenarios are just predictions that might not come true, or is the science pretty certain about the rising sea levels and such? I mean, what's the science telling us?
Maybe you go first.
Rexy.
Okay, based on what I read in the United Nations Environment Programme's report, if we are going to go ahead with our unconditional pledges at the moment, we are going to see about 3.2 Celsius rise by the end of this century. And even with 1.1 Celsius rise until now, 1.1, 1.2 Celsius rise, we are already seeing so many drastic weather impacts happening all over the world. The Australian fires, the Penang floods in 2017, all these are just symptoms of a growing problem. And yes, I mean, it will build up into something even more erratic, even more unpredictable over the years, if nothing is done.
So, okay. He's being an optimist.
Yeah. Right, okay. So that's the worst case scenario.
And you are a pessimist?
No, I'm not, but he's being an optimist with numbers. Because okay. I think, he's talking about unconditional, right?
Right.
So which means you take out these emission controls in an unconditional way. But we're not even doing that.
Okay.
So everybody's just doing whatever they want. Mm. So the reports that I read, it tells me that by 2050, we're definitely going to go beyond the 2 degrees. We're going to hit 4 degrees because the chart is just going that and we're not doing anything to pull it down.
Right.
So it's going to happen. So sea level rise is already happening. We've already seen it happening. And there's data on NARIM, National Hydrological Institute of Malaysia. You can find out. And different parts of the country are affected differently.
Okay.
So Sabah and Sarawak is quite badly affected, the coastal areas as well.
Is Penang Island, because I'm thinking specifically about island habitations like even Singapore. Yeah, are they more vulnerable than coastal cities?
It depends on your topography. So for Penang, actually, we're quite safe.
Penang Island.
Penang Island itself is quite safe, but the mainland, I think about half of the mainland will be affected.
Wow.
And a lot of it is paddy farms, right? And they're going to be inundated with salt water. Cool. So there's going to be a problem with you can't grow paddy. No, you're not going to be submerged,
right.
But you can't grow the same kind of crops anymore.
Which will affect those food security. Would affect food security.
Can
I just get you to elaborate on something, really? You mentioned just now the role of city planning when it comes mitigation and
adaptation.
Mitigation and adaptation. Can you explain to me the difference between the two?
Mitigation is what we can do to reduce our emissions. Right. So as Rexy said, you know, from an individual perspective, eat less meat, don't waste food, have less children, don't fly so much, you know, reduce your flying by half, you know, on a yearly basis, that sort of thing. So it reduces your emissions collectively, that helps cut down.
Okay.
Right. From a city maker's perspective, you need to get people to walk, take public transportation, ditch the car, that sort of thing. So that's mitigation.
Mm.
But adaptation is having in mind what's going to happen, what can you do now to adapt? How do you put in infrastructure, nature-based infrastructure, for instance, to deal with floods that are going to happen? How do you introduce infrastructure, and that also can be nature-based, to help with heat? So things like that.
Okay, all right, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to continue this conversation shortly on Consider This. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Consider This. Melissa and Sherrod here with you tonight. We're speaking to Rexy Prakash Chacko as well as Murali Ram, the co-authors of the book Creating Future-Proof Cities. Now, Sherrod, you had a question about technology.
Yeah, you know, I think it's, the pessimism aside, perhaps we look to the capacity of human beings to actually invent new things. Adaptation is actually part of our history. What do we know about the technological solutions to some of the problems, including like food wastage and the production of too much methane gas coming from rotting food?
Okay, so we talk about food, that's basically a waste issue. So there are plenty of solutions out there, waste to energy, for instance. In the past, we had issues with incinerators, dioxins,
right.
And there was a lot of resistance. But since we've come about 20, 30 years since, and there are a lot of solutions now, gasification, pyrolysis, that allows for treatment of wasted food into energy. So you don't get the methane released into the environment, but you need political buy-in. Or, you know, people need to know that this is not dangerous for your health, and actually it's actually quite necessary.
Right.
And you see that it's quite successful in countries like Sweden and Switzerland, and they actually derive a lot of their energy from food waste. The downside is, then you start wasting more food, thinking that that's okay.
Okay, because you think you have a solution.
You have a solution.
So you don't need to
manage
your
behavior.
So you
still need to manage the source issue.
Okay.
You know, you still need to reduce waste. Cities now are talking about smart city this, smart city that. And we need to link that smart city thinking into climate solutions. So even simple things like apps to help you move around. If I want to get from point A to B, how can I do it in a combination of the rapid KL and Grab?
Mm.
So you can say, okay, take a train here, this is how long it take you. That kind of solutions, you know. Charging people, congestion charges, RFIDs coming in, you have to pay. So technology is there, but how do you use it to push policy to change people's behavior?
So the buy-in whose buy-in do you need? Do you need the buy-in of the populace, the general populace, or is it the buy-in of, say, local government or policymakers?
So I would say both, but more the general populace.
Okay.
Because they need to be educated. If tomorrow the government says, oh, we need to start a congestion charge or a carbon tax,
sure,
there's going to be riots, right?
I mean,
you see that in Chile, you see that in Paris.
Sure.
When they want to do the right thing, but there's resistance. So here, obviously, any government is wary of being dethroned in the next election. So you need to educate the population about these issues and why these measures are important.
And on that note, I want to talk about the communication, the language that you use in writing this book. Now, Rexy, communication of climate issues is very important. I think it's a fine balance because you don't want to put people off. You want to get their buy-in. You want to educate them at the same time. But you also don't want to overwhelm them and be too alarmist and say, well, you know, the world's coming to an end. There's nothing you can do. So what type of tone and language did you adopt in this book to encourage the most action of the readers?
I think when it comes to climate communication, you have to be able to communicate the gravity of the situation, sure, as well as note that there is, of course, things that we can do, which we have to do, and we need to do it within this time. Mm. And what we did with this book is to actually summarize this communication in such a way that it gets to the reader and it hits straight on the action points. So that once, if someone were to just flip through the book, these are simple action steps that they can take, that they can convince their policymakers to take, and is also understandable to them. Because we need something that people can relate to, and which people can see as something which is cool and easy to do as
like
well.
Like solutions-based communication.
Okay. I mean, are there positive stories out there? I mean, it seems that there are countries that are taking the lead. China is, interestingly enough, authoritarian state, you know, pushing ahead on environmental strategies. And some democratic nations, you know, are falling behind precisely because democracy is this really messy thing when you have to bring everybody along. So where do you see, what are the positive stories that can be told?
Okay, so good thing is there are small countries leading the way.
Okay.
So Costa Rica, Slovenia, New Zealand recently came up with a zero carbon bill, and also another country, I forget, Sweden or something. The thing is, these are small countries, smaller than Malaysia. I mean, New Zealand, what, 5 million people, you know? And they're taking great strides because they realize that they are part of this global community. Now, the thing is, there's a whole opportunity. So it's how do you paint it as an opportunity of the green economy? So we're talking about solar panel installations, transitioning our energy sources from fossil fuels to non-fossil fuels. How do you cooperate with your neighboring countries to leverage on what they have? Local producers so that you cut on the transportation. Preserving your forests. I mean, Penang Hills Watch, you know, is... But it's not because you're saying it because you're an environmentalist. You're actually looking after our own well-being.
Right.
Because that's your carbon sink. That's your carbon sequestration sink. So we need to protect peat swamps, mangrove swamps, and rainforest. Mm-hmm. These are like the three big carbons in that order, which we don't seem to realize their importance, you know. So there are success stories out there, and these are small countries leading the way. But if many small countries get together, that becomes the norm, and it can push the bigger players like the US, for instance. Mm. In fact, in the US, although it's a national narrative, as you can see from Trump, but the cities are doing a lot of work. So I was very lucky to have spent some time in the US. The US state government sent me there to learn, and that was kind of the catalyst behind the book. We visited cities like Los Angeles and New Orleans, and who are doing great things to help mitigation and adaptation. And we can learn a lot from the cities.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, in the couple minutes that we have left, I'm wondering if both of you have a message for our viewers at home. What would you like, given this book that's been newly launched, what would you like the audience to know, to understand, about the climate crisis? Rexy, why don't you start?
I think one of the things that our viewers need to know is that we still have time to act, but that gap is getting smaller and smaller. So it is important to educate ourselves, make us aware of what is happening, and also to start action, not just individually, but also to put the pressure on our policymakers so that the climate issue becomes a determining issue when it comes to the elections, and it becomes a national narrative.
Right. Yeah. I would say if you don't have children, good for you. If you have children, then I think it's best you prepare and have a. You need to know what and what's going to happen. And there's also the issue of how do you communicate to your politicians.
Right.
So when you demand for action, we talk about climate action, this climate action, that climate strike. What actually are you asking? So you need to put it to the politicians or whoever your local representative may be, what kind of actions do you want in a localized area? Mm. So,
Be specific, is it?
Yeah. I have no car, no children. I think I'm on my way to getting a Nobel Prize.
Oh. That means you can you know, up your carbon emissions.
buy this book and read it.
Yes.
All right, thank you so much, gentlemen, for being on the show. We appreciate your time in explaining some of those you know, key issues about the climate crisis. That's all the time we have on Consider This for tonight's episode. I'm Melissa Idris, with me Sharad Kutan, signing off. Thank you for watching, and good night.